Tales of Two Cities, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Plenty of anti-immigrant sentiment at the Republican National Convention, but the host city, Cleveland, is looking for immigrants to fill jobs and help return the city to its former industrial glory.
While the passengers and the road have changed, the road is still the same. And my goal is to figure out, how do we get the engine going to that speed again? Because you know what turns out is greatness.
And immigration is key to that.
Immigration is so key.
And in Springfield, Massachusetts, people are upset about a Chinese manufacturer coming in to make railway cars, but not everyone's grumbling.
No matter what country they're from, they're going to be paying American taxes, so the source of where it's coming from really doesn't matter.
Those stories, today on The World. Day two of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Today, the official theme is Make America Work Again. So expect a lot of talk about creating jobs, stimulating growth, and the need to reverse President Obama's economic policies. Those are all topics that presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump has been hitting a lot. In a few minutes, we'll hear about a plan in Cleveland itself to attract more workers into the city. First, though, we head to the convention hall where the main speaker last night was the candidate's wife, Melania Trump.
I arrived in New York City 20 years ago, and I saw both the joys and hardships of daily life. On July 28, 2006, I was very proud to become citizens of the United States.
The speech drew cheers in the hall, but it was followed by a plagiarism controversy. Two passages uttered by Melania Trump were almost identical to passages in the speech given by Michelle Obama at the Democratic Convention in 2008. The World's Maria Muriel was in the convention hall last night and is now in the media room, otherwise known as the parking lot at the Quicken Loans Arena. So, Maria, last night, several speeches, including Melania's, that touched on immigration. What struck you about the tone and atmosphere of the evening?
I have to say, the evening was a little bizarre, Marco. The speakers, especially the speakers on immigration, there were three people whose children were killed by undocumented immigrants. The crowd would get really riled up and start chanting USA, USA, or Trump, Trump. It seemed aggressive, their rhetoric toward undocumented immigrants. And there was one speaker, Sabine Durden, who spoke about her son.
My best friend, my rock. My son, Dominic, my only child, was also killed by an illegal immigrant. I call them illegal aliens.
Yeah, so Durden there emphasizing the words illegal aliens. What did you think of that?
That was especially strange for me because I'm a journalist, and in our newsroom, our style is not to say illegal immigrants. The term that we use is undocumented immigrants. So it was kind of jarring to me to be in a place where the term illegal immigrants was used so often and so aggressively. Being an immigrant myself also, I felt at points uncomfortable being there because the crowd would get just so pumped up. And, you know, Sabine Durden is an immigrant herself. She came from Germany.
Yeah, so is the GOP drawing some kind of distinction between German, Slovenian, European immigrants and people south of the border or everybody else?
I don't know that they're doing exactly that, but what I have heard from talking to people here is they're drawing a very clear line between legal immigration and illegal immigration.
So the difference between legal and illegal immigrant, I mean, one of the people in the crowd last night was actually someone we've had on the show before, Marco Gutierrez. He's a Trump supporter and an immigrant himself from Mexico. You spoke with him today. What was his response to what he heard from Durden?
Marco agreed with me that the crowd's response to, you know, all of the talk about, quote unquote, illegal immigration was aggressive. And he did say that he has a different perspective now that he's come to the RNC about how Trump's base understands immigration. But he's still a Trump supporter, and he still believes that people should immigrate to the country legally.
And given everything that's going on today in the world, somebody like Marco Gutierrez still expects people from violent countries to go to their local consulates or embassies and go through the proper channels?
It appears so. You know, he is most interested in getting the government to create a possibility for those people to come over. He did say that he has relatives who are illegal immigrants, he called them, and friends as well.
Just Day listening to the crowd last night, did you feel any disconnect today when, like, Sabine Durden or Melania Trump got up to speak that these were also creating jobs, stimulating growth,
you know,
and
what?
To
I
reverse
actually didn't.
President
I
Obama's
feel
economic
like from
policies.
Spoken to
those are all
Trump
topics
supporters.
That presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump
is,
has been hitting,
you know,
a lot.
An immigrant,
in a few minutes,
fine,
we'll hear about a plan in Cleveland itself to attract more workers into the city. First, though, we head to the convention hall where the main speaker last night was the candidate's wife, Melania Trump.
I arrived in New York City 20 years ago,
so
and
I
saw both the joys and hardships
because they
of
really
daily
see
life.
It as a different thing when you cross
on
the border.
On July 28, 2006,
versus, you know, coming,
I was very proud to become
system.
Citizens
really
of the United States.
Was Maria Muriel in Cleveland at
the
Republican National Convention.
Cheers in the hall,
thank you, Maria. Followed by
tomorrow.
A plagiarism
Thanks, Marco.
Controversy.
Two at one time, Cleveland had a population
Trump
of nearly 1 million, and it was the sixth largest city in the U.S.
given by Michelle
but then factories
Obama
started to close,
at the Democratic
jobs
convention
disappeared,
in 2008. And the population
the world's
started
Maria
to shrink.
Muriel was
it's down
in the convention
to just
hall
under last night,
and is now in the media
but
room.
But Saul Gonzalez,
otherwise known as
the KCRW, reports
from
Cleveland.
There's a plan to bring those numbers
last night. Several speeches, including Melania's,
the founder of
touched on immigration.
A Cleveland-based publication that covers life in America. As Rust Belt cities.
Say,
and she
was
says signs
bizarre,
of Cleveland's
Marco.
Hard times
speakers,
are everywhere.
The speakers
there are a lot of abandoned
on immigration.
Houses
there were three
throughout
people
the city. There are a lot
children
of abandoned warehouses
by undocumented
and
immigrants
throughout the city.
A
so
crowd
there are a lot of
really
empty lots where there used to be buildings
chanting, USA,
where now you
USA,
are, they're just sort of reverting
Trump,
to nature.
Trump. It seemed
says Cleveland's problems had even afflicted the psyche of Clevelanders.
The term I like to use for it is reverse Schadenfreude. Right? So Schadenfreude is
my best friend,
joy in the downfall of others. I think Cleveland, to a certain extent, takes joy in its own downfall.
But
my
some in Cleveland have plans to bring the city's
boom times back.
Was also killed
by an illegal immigrant.
And the key to those plans, they
I
say,
call them illegal
is turning
aliens.
Cleveland into a magnet for immigrants and refugees.
Yeah, so Durden there emphasizing the words illegal aliens.
Coming.
What
Joe
did you think
Simperman
of that?
Is the director
that
of Global Cleveland,
me,
a nonprofit
a
group started by businesses in the city to attract immigrants to settle
to
here. Simperman believes newcomers from Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America will bring investment, jobs, and new ideas to Cleveland and restore
the
city
illegal
its
immigrants
glory.
Was used so
glory,
often,
says Simperman, that was created
so
by past waves of newcomers
myself
to the city,
also,
from Irish
I felt
immigrants to Eastern European refugees to African-Americans
the
from the deep south looking for factory
so
jobs in the
and,
north.
You
while the
know,
passengers
Sabine
on the road
Durden
have changed, the road
herself.
Is still the same.
From Germany.
And my goal
yeah, so
is to
the
figure
GOP
out how do we get the engine going to that speed again, because you know what turns out is greatness. And you, immigration is key to that.
I don't know that they're doing exactly that, but what I have heard from talking to people here is they're drawing a very clear line between
one immigrant
legal
who's found
immigration
success in Cleveland
and illegal immigration.
Is Leticia Ortiz,
so
the owner of La
the difference
Bamba,
between
Cleveland's
legal
first
and, illegal
and only
immigrant.
Tortilla
I mean,
manufacturing
one of the
plant.
In the crowd last night was
we started
actually
our business
we've had
in the
on the show
foot
before,
industry.
Marco Gutierrez,
we're going
he's a
to start very soon selling our
himself
product to
you
to
spoke
the
with him today. What
market.
Was his response to
born in Mexico,
what he heard
Ortiz settled in Cleveland 15 years ago. She represents a bright spot in the city's demographic picture,
the
slow but steady increase in the city's immigrant Latino population.
And he
in
did
fact,
say that he has
in all
a different
but one of Ohio's 88 counties, population growth
Trump's
is being driven by people who identify themselves
but
as immigrants and non-immigrant
and
Latino.
So I see more Latinos coming to
and
Cleveland.
And given
and
everything
they
that's going on
they
today
make
in the world, somebody like Marco Gutierrez still expects people
we're
from violent countries to
different
go
businesses
to their local consulates or embassies
before,
and go through the proper
was
channels.
Most,
it appears
American
so,
people
you know,
who
he
have their
is
business
most interested in getting
now you
the
see
government
more Latinos
to
opening different
create
kind
a
of
possibility
businesses.
For those people
and
to
while
come
many
over,
current
he did
residents
say that
still look to leave
who
Cleveland
who
for better opportunities
them,
elsewhere, Ortiz has no plans.
Just listening to the crowd last night, did you feel any disconnect when like Sabine Durden or Melania Trump got up to speak that these were also
vacation?
The irony, of course,
you know
is even
I
as Cleveland
didn't.
Works to attract a larger
like
foreign-born population like Ortiz, it's hosting a Republican political convention this week where
you know,
anti-immigrant
an
rhetoric
immigrant,
is intense.
Fine,
but Joe Simperman of Global Cleveland says the convention is just one week
law,
in the life of the
which
city.
Is what Melania
and when
Trump
it wraps
did,
up
right?
and the delegates
came
go home,
states,
he
like
says
said,
Cleveland will continue
ago,
to promote itself as a beacon for refugees and immigrants.
We are going to continue to disprove the theory that immigration is bad
because they really see it as a different thing. thrives. Cross the border, or
and after people leave, we're going to double down and welcome
versus,
even more.
You know, coming
and the Republican convention
the
is creating
system.
Business
really
opportunities for Cleveland's immigrants, like Leticia Ortiz. She's
well,
been
Maria
invited
Muriel
to set up a kiosk
the
at the convention,
convention
to promote her
Thank you,
tortillas.
Maria. Talk tomorrow.
Ortiz
Thanks,
doesn't agree with much of the Republican
At one time,
Party's
Cleveland had a population
platform,
of nearly 1 million, and it was the sixth largest city in the U.S. But then factories started to close, jobs disappeared, and the population started to shrink. It's down to just under 400,000.
So we wanted to take
but it's
advantage
Gonzalez
of that.
Station
so it's,
KCRW
it's a great opportunity.
From Cleveland. There's
the
a
world,
plan to bring those
Saul
numbers
Gonzalez,
back.
Cleveland.
And Trubeck
is
later
the
on the show how one
Belt.
Chinese company is helping create jobs
publication
here in the U.S.
That covers life
Stay tuned for that.
Rust Belt cities.
It's got to be a
and
frustrating time for Russian
Cleveland's
athletes hoping to compete at next
everywhere.
Month's Rio Olympics.
There are a lot of abandoned
First, Russian
houses.
Athletes were banned
the
from
city,
all track and field events in Rio. And now the International Olympic Committee is considering banning Russia from the Games altogether. It's not a done deal, but a very real possibility. So all that work and training could be all
for naught.
The reason all this is happening is that a major investigation
like
has found evidence of a massive state-run
right? so
doping scheme in Russia involving
joy
athletes
in the downfall
in multiple
of others.
Sports.
I think
Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow. What is the general response
downfall?
There to this report,
but some in
Charles?
Well, obviously,
plans
the Russians
bring
don't
the
agree with the conclusions that were made by this
and
Water
the key
Commission.
To those plans,
the general
they say,
response here,
is
I would
turning
say,
Cleveland
been
into a magnet for immigrants and refugees. We don't thrive if we don't have an expert coming. Joe Simperman is the director of Global Cleveland, a nonprofit group started by businesses
States.
In
now,
the
he
city
did that,
to attract
course,
immigrants to settle
after
here.
Two of his
Simperman believes newcomers
died,
from Asia, the Middle East,
so,
and Latin America will bring investment,
so
jobs, and
a
new ideas
A new Moscow
to Cleveland
Times poll shows that anti-American sentiment is
glory.
At a 10-year
says Simperman
low
that was created
and
by
yet,
past waves
Putin
of newcomers
would like
to
Russians
the city
to believe
from Irish immigrants,
if Russia doesn't make it to Rio,
refugees,
the United States
to African
How long can
he
keep going back to the
looking for blame
America
jobs in the North?
Well,
the passengers
it seems
the road
to go pretty well
the
for
him,
I have to say. It's lower,
my
but it's
goal
still
is
pretty
to
high.
Figure out how do we get the engine going
but I do
to
think
that
there
speed
is
again,
that
because you know what turns out is greatness.
I mean, and okay, you, yes, America's at fault for meddling in everything, including the Olympics and this doping scandal that we see unfolding. But there is kind of a general sense of slight de-escalation
found
in
success in
the rhetoric that you hear out of Moscow
Ortiz,
these days.
The owner of La Bamba,
to give examples, for
Cleveland's first and only
tortilla
manufacturing plant.
We started our business.
The NATO Russia Council had, okay, they still disagree on just about everything, but they at least agreed to regulate these flybys that were happening
in the Baltics
and in the Black Sea
that
were really a source of concern to everyone involved.
It represents a bright spot in the city's demographic picture.
So it looks like the International Olympic Committee decided to punt
this in the city's immigrant Latino population.
Well, there are a lot of moving pieces that are all happening at the same time, and certainly there's not much time for the Games in Rio.
Driven by people who identify themselves as immigrant and non-immigrant Latino.
So I see more Latino.
Athletes appeal
for and they
participation
see,
in the
they
Rio
can
Games. That got underway today, and they announced
I
they expect
them
to make some kind of decision Thursday.
Different
but that was always
going to
be the case,
Cleveland.
And that was
before
this Water Commission
was
report
most,
came out yesterday. So
American
in a way,
people
the fallout from the Water Commission
or
report may just blow away any chance
now you
of
see
some
more
kind of
Latinos
appeal.
Whether Russia
of
heads to Rio or not,
and
what has all this done to Russian athletics and their glorious past
for better opportunities elsewhere? Ortiz has no plans to pull up stakes.
Well, it's a disaster. There's no doubt about that. I mean, this is the reputation of Russian sports.
There's no reason to go to the
tatters, and you know, given how closely
just for vacation.
Vladimir Putin in particular
the irony, of course, is even as Cleveland works to attract a larger foreign-born population like Ortiz, it's hosting a Republican political convention
this week
where anti-immigrant rhetoric is intense. But Joe Simperman of Global Cleveland says the convention is just one week in the life of the city. And when it wraps up and the delegates go home, he says Cleveland will continue to promote itself as a beacon for refugees and immigrants.
We are going to continue to disprove the theory
or not,
that immigration is bad by being the
scandals
city
that, kind of keep
that
on
thrives.
Giving.
And after
Reporter
people
Charles
leave, Maines we're going to double down
and
welcome
even
more.
And
thank
the Republican
you.
Convention
What's
is
the likelihood
creating
that Turkish cleric in Pennsylvania will be sent back to Turkey
like
to answer charges he was
She's
behind the coup d'etat there?
Kiosk
we'll find out later here on the world.
Ortiz doesn't agree with much of the Republican Party's immigration platform, but she says it's too good of an opportunity to pass up.
It's just that we're there to show our businesses. We know there are going to be people from all over. So we wanted to take advantage of that. So it's a great opportunity.
For the world, Saul Gonzalez, Cleveland.
Later on the show, how one Chinese company is helping create jobs here in the U.S. Stay tuned for that. It's got to be a frustrating time for Russian athletes hoping to compete at next month's Rio Olympics. First, Russian athletes were banned from all track and field events in Rio, and now the International Olympic Committee is considering banning Russia from the Games altogether. It's not a done deal, but a very real possibility. So all that work and training could be all for naught. The reason all this is happening is that a major investigation has found evidence of a massive state-run doping scheme in Russia involving athletes in multiple sports. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow. What is the general response there to this report, Charles?
Well, obviously the Russians don't agree with the conclusions that were made by this WADA commission. The general response here, I would say, has been an effort to discredit it. They've pointed out what they call sort of doubting the sourcing of the accusations. They point out this is coming from essentially one man, the former head of the Russian anti-doping agency, who fled to the United States. Now, he did that, of course, after two of his colleagues died unexpectedly. So that isn't mentioned so often.
A new Moscow Times poll shows that anti-American sentiment is at a 10-year low there. And yet Putin would like Russians to believe that if Russia doesn't make it to Rio, it's the United States' fault. How long can he keep going back to the blame America well?
Well, it seems to go pretty well for him, I have to say. It's lower, but it's still pretty high. And so, yeah. But I do think there is a sense that there's some mixed signals coming from the top. I mean, okay, yes, America's at fault for meddling in everything, including the Olympics and this doping scandal that we see unfolding. But there is kind of a general sense of slight de-escalation in some of the rhetoric that you hear out of Moscow these days. To give examples, for Putin wished a happy 4th of July to Obama. That doesn't usually happen. Mm. The NATO-Russia Council had, they still disagree on just about everything, but they at least agreed to regulate these flybys that were happening in the Baltics and in the Black Sea that were really a source of concern to everyone involved.
So it looks like the International Olympic Committee decided to punt this decision. What is next?
Well, there are a lot of moving pieces that are all happening at the same time, and certainly there's not much time before the games in Rio. The CAS, this is the Court for Arbitration of Sport, is a meeting to decide on Russian track and field appeal, athletes' appeals for participation in the Rio Games. That got underway today, and they announced they expect to make some kind of decision Thursday. But that was always going to be the case, and that was before this WADA Commission report came out yesterday. So in a way, the fallout from the WADA Commission report may just blow away any chance of some kind of appeal.
Whether Russia heads to Rio or not, what has all this done to Russian athletics and their glorious past where, they'd always have a bunch of gold medals to flaunt?
Well, it's a disaster. There's no doubt about that. I mean, this is the reputation of Russian sport is in complete tatters. And, given how closely the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin in particular, has wrapped himself in restoring sort of Russia's sporting might, it just looks bad all the way around. The idea that Sochi, the success at Sochi in Russia came in number one in the medal count in Sochi, that was done through cheating, perhaps the hints that they have with problems with racism and bribes and fan behavior at the World Cup. That's coming up in 2018. This is just the sense that these triumphs, and they were seen as triumphs here, either deservedly or not, now turn out to be sort of scandals that kind of keep on giving.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thank you as always, Charles.
Hey, thank you.
What's the likelihood that Turkish cleric in Pennsylvania will be sent back to Turkey to answer charges he was behind the coup d'etat there? We'll find out later here on The World. As we mentioned a few minutes ago, today's theme at the Republican National Convention is Make America Work Again. Presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump says he would do that by creating more jobs here in America and by stopping American jobs from being moved overseas to countries like China. That does happen, U.S. jobs moving to China, but some Chinese companies are creating jobs here, too. The World's Jason Margolis has one example of that.
Here in Boston, we have a love-hate relationship with our subway. We call it the T.
Next stop, Newton Center.
The clickety-clack of the old rail lines can be charming, and Boston has an extensive underground network. But the subway cars are jam-packed during rush hour, and sometimes unreliable, especially come winter. And the cars? Many are old. Some have been carrying passengers for 46 years. But in about 3 years, Boston riders should start enjoying nearly 300 new Chinese and American-built rail cars.
These are state-of-the-art vehicles that will have CCTV-operated display screens, LCD monitors, larger seats, wider doors.
That's native Bostonian Lydia Rivera, who is now a spokesperson with CRRCMA. That's short for China Railway Rolling Stock Corporation, Massachusetts. CRRC is the largest railcar maker on the planet, but Boston marks the Chinese state-owned company's first foray into a U.S. market. When Massachusetts officials selected CRRC, the company agreed to perform at least 60% of the work in the U.S.
The shells are designed in China, and everything else that goes into the car, all the electronics, everything, all the technology, that's all happening in Massachusetts.
Almost 100 miles west in Springfield, where CRRC has begun construction on a new factory. Kevin Kennedy is Springfield's chief development officer.
I was born and raised here and have been here for all 64 years.
Kennedy has seen his city's slow and steady decline over the past four decades, a familiar tale in manufacturing centers across the country.
Well, we used to have the Indian motorcycle that was big and prominent here. We had the Duryea automobile. We had the GB airplane. Actually, the first Rolls-Royce in America was made here in Springfield.
I met Kennedy at a largely vacant 42-acre lot. In about a year, CRRC's new factory will be up and running.
They will be employing upwards of 150 to 200 people at an average wage of $66,000.
CRRC will also pay Springfield $2.7 million annually in taxes. This alone won't transform the area.
But psychologically, the fact that manufacturing is coming back to a city that formerly has a history of manufacturing is really the big thing, perception, the psychology that goes with that.
At the same time, there's been some grumbling about a Chinese manufacturer setting up shop in Massachusetts. It's understandable. Politicians love to vilify China. That's unfair in this case, though, says William Ibbs, a civil engineering professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He says American companies haven't built rail cars for about 20 years.
It was a slow business. It was also an erratic business. There wasn't a real steady demand.
Canadian, Italian, Japanese, and Korean manufacturers have largely filled the void. And now the Chinese. Of course, there's always a risk going with a new supplier. A few years back in Boston, riders on new subway cars were literally sliding out of their seats. The chairs were made from different materials and were a few inches wider. Ibbs says he's seen things go the other way as well, with people bunched too tightly on foreign-made cars.
And I'm not going to name the country, but the residents of that country are smaller in stature than Americans, so they had sized the seats according to their domestic population rather than the American butt, if you will.
Posterior sizing aside, Ibbs says going with an established Chinese firm is a small gamble and one well worth taking. Boston is getting a great deal to upgrade aging infrastructure. CRRC's bid was hundreds of millions lower than most of its competitors. Ibbs says the Chinese are bidding low now, thinking about the long game.
They want to get into this market because it's not only providing the cars, it's the servicing and the future business prospects that they're looking for.
The Chinese are also pursuing railcar contracts in Los Angeles, New York, and Philadelphia. If they win, those cars could potentially be built at Springfield's new facility. So while some politicians continue to attack China, local leaders like Kevin Kennedy are trying to make their cities more attractive to Chinese investors.
No matter what country they're from, they're going to be paying American taxes, so the source of where it's coming from really doesn't matter.
For the world, Jason Margolis, Springfield, Massachusetts.
The Lancet, the British medical journal, just published a report with some stark new figures on HIV infections. It says new infections globally have leveled off at 2.5 million a year, which means slow progress in actually reducing the number of new HIV infections. The report coincides with an international AIDS conference, which is underway in Durban, South Africa this week. Our BBC colleague Karen Allen has been reporting on another worrying trend in South Africa. Women with HIV who take their antiretroviral drugs, or ARVs, in secret. Here's her conversation with one woman who only wanted to use her first name.
My name is Julia. I'm 42 years old. I've got the three children, and my sister was dying and left one child. I'm HIV positive. I take my drugs. My husband is not, no. I put it into the safe place in my drawer. No one knows. Don't touch my drawer. The underwear drawer is a safe place. 8 o'clock in the morning, I start take my pills.
So this is your secret. Your husband does not know.
Does not know. Nothing, no. I tell my husband, I'm coming to the clinic. Say I'm have a high blood pressure.
And you change the packets where the drugs are in?
Yes, I check in the packet. I put in the packets of high blood pressure.
So it's your secret?
That is my secret.
Why can't you tell your husband that you are taking ARVs?
He divorced me. You're going to leave me. That's why I tell you, if you are married with a Zulu guy, hey, they're very stubborn, that person. She says, if you don't have that, you're going to leave me. How must I do now? Must go back to struggle again to get another man to support this kid. No, it's not mine. It's two of us for these children. I must stay with that secret. She's going to get that secret the day I was died.
You're going to carry it with you to the grave?
Yes, until the grave.
Do you think your husband would go and get tested for HIV?
Yeah, she's got to take a HIV tested. Coming back with the results, there's nothing wrong about him. He's very clean.
Is there not a danger that you may infect him?
No, I don't. She can ask me, why, if I sleep with you, same as use a condom? I say, I don't need another children. This three is okay, my darling man.
You're giving me a big wink as you say that and smiling.
Do you know that? And I say, no, I'm okay with my life. With the three children, I'm so okay. I say, fine.
Extraordinary. That was Julia, a South African who is HIV positive, speaking with the BBC's Karen Allen. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The fallout from the failed coup in Turkey continues. Today, the government fired thousands of teachers and ministry bureaucrats with alleged ties to the coup plotters.
It looks a lot more like a purge than justice being served for Friday night when the attempted coup had happened.
That story plus a refugee dance party in Paris. That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Tens of thousands of people are out of their jobs today in Turkey. They're accused by the government of being involved with a failed military coup last Friday night. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had promised swift punishment for anyone behind the uprising, but the list of those removed from their posts goes well beyond members of the military. There are police officers, judges, and a lot of teachers. Many in Turkey have been left scratching their heads about all of this. One of them is reporter and friend of the show, Dalia Mortada in Istanbul.
Well, it looks a lot more like a purge than justice being served for Friday night when the attempted coup had happened. Basically, everyone that is being rounded up is allegedly tied to Fethullah Gulen and his movement, the Gulen movement. The network that operates under the Gulen name is vast, and they fill positions through all segments of Turkish society, including public sector jobs. And what it looks like is that anyone who could possibly be associated with this movement, and reports of people who are definitely not associated with this movement, but could be people who are dissenting, are being cleared out from the government. And from educational positions, we've had the state broadcaster TRT just announced that 1,577 deans in the country have been asked to resign from their posts, deans of universities.
Wow.
And, you know, 15,000 teachers or people from the education ministry, largely made up of teachers.
And so officials are saying these are people who are Gulenists, therefore they had a hand in the attempted coup?
That's exactly what they're saying. They're saying they're associated with this movement. It was recently, a couple of months ago, declared a terrorist organization, actually, the Fethullah Gulen movement. And so that means that they would be part of a terror organization. This is something technical in Turkish law. It's really easy, because they're so vague, it's really easy to sort of umbrella basically anyone under a terror organization. But as of right now, that's exactly what they're saying. They're accusing them of being involved with the coup by being associated with this movement.
Don't the officials have to somehow prove that they are Gulenists? And how would they do that?
You would think so. So the Gulen movement, I mean, it could be that they graduated from one of the tutoring schools. That's what the Gulen movement is best known for. They're actually heavily involved in education, which is why I'm not as surprised to see that the Ministry of Education was hit, and that even private schools are being targeted and universities are being targeted, because the movement itself is very heavily focused on education. And so for all we know, associations could be as loose or as thin as these people had graduated from these tutoring schools that are widely known throughout Turkey, or they could be more involved. And that could be enough for proof, considering that also 3,000 judges have been sacked. Who knows what's going to happen with the judiciary and with law enforcement? We're looking also at another 9,000 police officers who have been sacked.
So what will happen to all these people?
Right now, a lot of the language I've been seeing actually has been conflicting. We're looking at suspensions versus removal from office or removal. Mm. And so some of these people haven't actually lost their jobs. Right now, as of today, they're just suspended. They're waiting, especially okay. If they're in schools, they're not going to be heavily impacted because schools aren't in session right now. But what's going to happen to them? I have no idea. The question that I'm really looking to answer is, what's going to happen with all of these vacancies? We're looking at huge gaps in security personnel. We're looking at huge gaps in education, and how these positions are going to be filled. I'm not really sure.
So is this a window of opportunity for Erdogan to just clear out critics with an iron fist? And do you think there are going to be more arrests and suspensions?
That's what it appears to be. Critics are definitely saying that Erdogan has cast a much wider net than anyone could be involved in this coup. I mean, we're looking at somewhere between, if you include the military, maybe about 50,000 or more people dismissed or suspended from their jobs. About 10,000 people have been detained. And so if all of those people were involved with the coup, I would think that word would have gotten out pretty publicly at that point. And so critics are definitely saying that Erdogan has cast a much wider net. People have been talking about a witch hunt and an opportunity to purge the government and really sort of society from any dissent. I would guess that people are afraid to speak up and to voice their opinions more than they had already been as a result of these developments.
Reporter Dalia Mortada in Istanbul. Thank you very much, Dalia.
Thank you, Marco, for having me.
The attempted coup in Turkey didn't last long. It started Friday night. By Saturday morning, it was pretty much done. But for a few hours at least, it looked like it was possible that the coup plotters could come out on top. That's according to Karim Shaheen, who reports from Ankara for The Guardian.
They actually came really close to succeeding. There were some very crucial moments when it looked like it could go either way. And that was certainly the belief among the government officials who were in crisis cabinet meetings and were watching the situation unfold. I give an example at the beginning of the piece of a cabinet meeting with nine of the senior ministers who were gathered at the prime ministry office in Ankara. They were sitting there and watching state TV fall under the military's control. They didn't know if the issue was within the chain of command, whether this was endorsed by the leadership of the army or not. They had been trying for an hour before declaring it a coup to get in touch with the military chief of staff, General Hulusi Akar, and they weren't able to reach him. So they didn't know who was actually endorsing it and who to trust. And before the president spoke on FaceTime, it looked like they may well die. And that's what one of the ministers says, is that, you know, we're all going to die today. So just be prepared and don't worry about the future. Mm. And he sends for his personal weapon.
Is there one moment that shows just how close the rebels were to taking control?
Well, I think the key issue was, you know, their attempt to detain the president. The president was at a resort in a place called Marmaris, and he had left the hotel where he was staying just 20 minutes before the coup plotters arrived at the hotel and attacked it. And his plane took off from an airstrip not far away from Marmaris and was in the air when two F-16 fighter jets were quite close and were harassing the plane. And they asked it to identify itself, and the pilot told them that it was a Turkish Airlines flight, and so they didn't shoot it down. So that maybe was the closest moment at which the coup came to succeeding.
Is it certain the coup makers would have succeeded if only they had killed President Erdogan, or were there more pieces of the puzzle that they still needed to line up to be successful?
There are definitely more pieces of the puzzle, but it would have been a terrible decisive blow to the government if something had happened to the president, if he'd been detained or assassinated. The two key elements that prevented the coup from succeeding was the ability of the president to actually go on national television and call on people to come out to the streets. It was really a combination of the people's willingness to go out into the streets and not be intimidated by the military and the president, you know, intervening decisively at that moment.
President Erdogan appearing on FaceTime, that was a really weird moment, just in terms of power and control. I mean, he must have been taking a huge risk appearing through two looking glasses, the FaceTime app through a TV screen. It doesn't exactly project, I'm here, I'm in charge.
Yeah, and there's a very amusing moment during the cabinet meeting when they see him on FaceTime, and you know, one of the ministers is like, what is this FaceTime thing, and why don't I have it? So yeah, I mean, it was a very strange, very odd response to the coup attempt. I guess it's a sign of the times. I mean, critics of the president have accused him of clamping down on social media and, you know, on Twitter and such. And so it was quite ironic to see him using these mediums to call on the people to actually take to the streets and resist an attempt to overthrow him.
Who were you able to speak to from the Erdogan government in the days since the coup? And, like, what were they thinking and saying as the coup was unfolding? Like, what did they think when, you know, President Erdogan appears on FaceTime via TV?
So there are multiple officials that I spoke to for this particular story. One of the key guys is Jamaluddin Hashemi, who's mentioned in the story as a senior advisor to Prime Minister Ben Ali Yildirim. And he was actually present in those cabinet meetings. And, you know, he was describing to me once the tanks come out into the streets, he had gone out to survey what was going on in Ankara and came back to the prime ministry, went straight to the undersecretary and asked him, you know, is this real? And the undersecretary, who had been trying to reach the chief of staff for the last hour, says, yes, it is real, but we don't know if it's within the military's chain of command or if it's outside the military's chain of command.
Yeah, so bottom line here, Karim, Turks are glad the coup didn't succeed, but how satisfied and how certain are Turks that this open wound after the attempted coup is going to heal?
Yeah, it's a huge dilemma. I mean, as you said, a lot of people are happy that the coup failed, but a lot of people are not happy that Erdogan is in power, and they're not happy about what they expect will be a concerted campaign to quash the Gulenists and to defeat them systematically and comprehensively. And, you know, the officials I've spoken to have said that absolutely we're going to go, you know, as far as required to cleanse the bureaucracy of Gulenist influence. So it's going to be a long campaign and definitely going to raise questions about Turkey's commitment to freedoms, Turkey's commitment to democratic values. But from their perspective, from the government's perspective, they've just been proven right about what they've been warning about, you know, for the last two, three years, that there's an attempt to overthrow the state that's unfolding and that they need to combat it.
Reporter Karim Shaheen with The Guardian joining us from Ankara, the Turkish capital. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Let's return now to Fethullah Gulen. He's the cleric currently living in Pennsylvania who's accused by the Turkish government of plotting the failed coup attempt. Officials in Ankara want to prosecute him, and they're asking Washington to help. Sherif Basiouni is a professor of law at DePaul University in Chicago. He has served as an advisor to the U.S. State Department. Let me ask you about this extradition request for Fethullah Gulen. Turkey's filed an official request. What is supposed to happen next?
Turkey probably filed a request pursuant to Article 10 of the extradition treaty between the U.S. and Turkey, which means that it basically can be a one-pager. It doesn't have to contain any documents or any evidence, and it has up to 60 days to prepare its file of evidence. And so this gives Turkey the opportunity to put somebody like Gulen in prison for 60 days without anything more than just send a letter.
So does Turkey now expect the United States to detain Gulen for up to 60 days?
That's my guess. And frankly, in very rare occasions, have I seen the Office of International Affairs sort of not go along with such a request. And that would usually be when the Department of Justice, with the advice of the Department of State, considers the request as being fundamentally flawed or patently politically motivated.
So what is extraditable according to the U.S.? I mean, like, once Turkey pulls that dossier together in the next 60 days, what's the U.S. going to want to see in it?
If the crime charged by Turkey is a political crime, for example, it says, well, he committed treason or espionage or sedition, or he tried to change the regime, that may be considered a political offense, and that is not extraditable, both under U.S. jurisprudence and under international law. However, if the political offense in question is also combined with the commission of a common crime, then it's possible to extradite.
If Turkey checks off all the boxes of their extradition request, is the U.S. obliged to send Gulen back?
Well, the answer is yes, but when you say if it checks all the right boxes, I think it's a very, very difficult thing. And let me tell you why. First, Turkey will have to show that he has committed a crime, which is an extraditable crime and not just simply a political offense crime, assuming that they are able to connect him to the coup that happened. Being connected with a coup is political. They would have to show more in order to connect him with the violence that may have ensued. So that's number one. Number two, they need to have evidence of probable cause. How are they going to prove that him sitting in Pennsylvania?
They would need like an email that says, please go out and stage a coup, something like that, right?
Well, either that or taped conversations or somebody who is a witness or people who can testify that he participated in meetings and directed people to engage in violence. This is quite difficult to achieve.
So, Sherif Bassiouni, what do you think is going to happen ultimately? Will Gulen be extradited or not?
I think it's going to be a long legal and political battle. I think that if the U.S. really acts in a principled way, it will look at the request of Turkey and will say simply that it just needs more evidence to make sure that this is not a politically motivated request for extradition, and that there is more that Turkey has in terms of evidence of criminality rather than simply allegations and claims of some political involvement. And if the U.S. acts in such a principled way from the beginning, then obviously Turkey is going to raise the ante. I mean, Erdogan is going to pull all stops. Knowing how determined he is to become the next dictator of Turkey, he's quite likely to start busing Syrian refugees to Greece and then create all sorts of chaos with the EU. So he's got his pieces in place, and he is quite likely to use them. And so the question is whether the Obama administration is going to show some backbone or is just going to cave in.
Sherif Bassiouni, Emeritus Professor of Law at DePaul University, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Before we go to the break, a preview of a story we'll have for you tomorrow about immigrants in Hollywood, actors, Russian actors. A talent agent tells his Russian clients, lose your accent.
And I have, in my, 29 years experience in that business, I have few people who got rid of accent completely.
The agent never bothered to lose his accent, but some of his clients did.
Without accent, you're American.
But then what if you're auditioning for the part of a Russian?
So I talk with my Russian accent like this, and I'm like, hi, my name is Alena Savostikova, yeah, is Russia, I talk Russian.
This Russian got cast for a different part as an American.
And this has been happening all the time lately, and I'm not complaining.
Russians making it in Hollywood, that's tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Let's head back to Cleveland now for another update from the Republican National Convention. Before the convention started, there were concerns about protests and possible unrest. There have been protests in Cleveland, but happily things have remained pretty calm. My colleague Leo Hornack usually holds down The World's offices in London, but we sent him to Cleveland this week to give us his outsider's view of the convention. So what kind of protests have you seen? And I'm curious, Leo, is Black Lives Matter present at the convention?
If you just step outside the security barriers, there have been scattered protests by Black Lives Matter, but they're generally outnumbered by other anti-Trump protesters. There was one group that I bumped into yesterday, a group from New York, a Black Lives Matter group of about 10 activists. They were amongst maybe 200 other anti-Trump protesters.
So what is the specific message they are trying to send, the small group of Black Lives Matter protesters?
Well, the message is very similar to what we've heard before, that police killings of young black men, overwhelmingly men, must end and are going unaccounted for. But what's interesting is when I met up with this group of Black Lives Matter activists, led by a guy from New York called Hawk Newsom, He told me that, in fact, his plan was to change the message and to add a new message, a really surprising one to me as an outsider. His message was, I ain't voting. And he had that on his T-shirt. You know, coming from Britain, where we've heard about the civil rights movement for decades, as I understood previously, the centerpiece of that movement was trying to make sure that all races had the right to vote, to exercise their democratic rights. This was something dramatically different. His argument was that if black people in America withhold their vote from the two major parties, those parties will have to start competing for it. And that message, of course, goes overwhelmingly in his mind to the Democratic Party, to Hillary. Here's what he told me this morning in Cleveland.
Neither party has stepped to the forefront and made Black Lives Matter a priority. Hillary Clinton has been traveling, she's been promoting herself, and she has the votes of millions of African Americans in her hands. The problem is we are settling, and what we want right now is our fair share of justice.
Interesting point of view. Compete for our vote. Earn it. Leo, you're in essence our foreign correspondent watching this classic American spectacle and now a spectacle on steroids. What have you found surprising in this whole dynamic between the Black Lives Matter activists outside and what's going on inside the convention center itself?
What's really struck me yesterday when I was watching Rudy Giuliani's speech, he spent a huge amount of his speech talking about how police are not corrupt, how the police are the heroes of America. And that all of that, I felt, was an implicit answer to the protests of people like Hawk Newsom, who you just heard. What really struck me, though, was how this has, in some ways, parallels but differences with Britain. In 2011, I was living in London at the time of the London riots. Cities across the country went up in flames, and that was sparked by a very similar incident in the east of London. A young black man was shot dead by police. The police alleged he was armed. Other people argued with that. And protests in response to that killing, an anger spiral to an extent, that the city started to burn. What I've been really struck by is how it's gone in it goes in a different direction in this country, or so far it has gone in a different direction. That these killings have generated a political movement that is actually interested in demonstrating outside Donald Trump's convention center or in addressing a message to Hillary Clinton. In other words, it's a movement which is still very much engaged with mainstream political parties. And that's something that we never saw in our country in 2011.
Well, a different direction perhaps than the London and UK in 2011, but there is the backdrop of those awful shootings of police officers in Dallas and Baton Rouge and the seemingly incessant killings of black men by police. My colleague Leo Hornack in Cleveland giving us his outsider's eyes on the Republican National Convention. Thanks for your time today, Leo.
No problem, Marco. Thank you.
Finally today, we head to Paris. In recent months, there have been a couple of high-profile cases in the French capital involving police shutting down refugee and migrant encampments there. So a group of volunteers decided to organize an event that would generate a different message about refugees and migrants. They organized a dance party. Here's Emma Jacobs in Paris.
Paris summers mean long days, light until after 10 p.m. On a cool evening in a plaza in a northeastern neighborhood of the city, a couple hundred people are gathered around a DJ booth, some dancing, some standing around talking. The bass thumps across the park. It's not a typical event for refugees. It's not even just for refugees.
Well, everybody like to dance. Some people, they doesn't understand each other language.
Nasrullah Delatse is an Afghan refugee from Kabul who's been in France for 18 months.
And we are always together now, like French or Europe, all the country people in Asia from every country, all of. But it's not all the time this happened.
The organizers of the event called it the Migrant Ball, inviting DJs to play world music for a crowd that grows over the course of the evening. Mathias Izimat-Marin is part of a duo called Les Fumisteries, invited to perform.
Le problème, c'est que c'est souvent un rapport à la nécessité.
The problem, he says, is that the relationship between Parisians and migrants is often one based on need. Quentin Morlot, who's been working with refugees as a volunteer, chimes in.
Ça change de la charité, d'un événement, voilà. C'est juste dans le besoin. C'est juste
voilà,
quelque
en fait.
Chose où on se rassemble. Et même si
this event is a change from charity, Morlot says. It's not certain we'll get people to interact with just one of these. Maybe it's a little utopian to say that just one time a lot of people will talk with each other or whatever. But it's a first step. There are families here with children, but the majority of the new arrivals are young men, many from Afghanistan or countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Merin acknowledges the negative effects of incidents like the sexual assaults in Cologne, Germany, during New Year's celebrations, reportedly mostly by young North African migrants. I think it would be good all the same to try and counteract the energy of that, he says. Passersby, attracted by the music, seem to approve. Salim Ben Khalid moved to France from Tunisia 9 years ago. In France, there's often a disconnect between the French and foreigners, he says. He stresses that it doesn't have to be that way, but he thinks it is important to do things actively to bridge that gap. Maybe one way can be music, he says. But Morteza Beboudi does hope that people will hear not just the music, but also the refugees' accounts of their often rough living conditions in Paris.
That the people should know about their stories, because, you know, the story is so important to know about the refugee.
The 22-year-old photographer and journalist from Afghanistan has spent most of his life as a refugee in Iran and arrived in France only recently. He's living with the family of a French journalist, but it's not far from here to the elevated metro tracks that have at times sheltered hundreds of people.
I'm thinking about others sleeping with their families under the metro in the streets at the night. You know, it's so difficult for them.
Each of the refugees has their own story, and it's important, he says, that someone hears you. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Paris.
And I'm Marco Werman. The World comes to you from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.